let's draw the conference to a close. You have all your speakers here, minus one or two, and it's time for you to really ask the questions that you want to ask. Somebody has suggested that we might just ask them in words of one syllable to say if they have any comments on the if they were in here, of the people I've just shown. Anybody like to talk about that? Do you have agency? Do you not have agency? This actually goes right to you, doesn't it?
Right, so... Okay, help, can you hear me? Well, I guess I'd say there, I mean, the person, whatever that is, has agency. I mean, he is raising his arm, he's moving around, he went to meet you, and all of those things, right? So they have agency objectively. From the outside, we see them having agency. Now, you might wonder, do they have a sense of agency, as in a subjective experience of agency? And again, that you might even dissect that into two parts. Like, do they have a sense of deciding what to do? And so, you know, Rupert Spira, when he raised his arm, and the other one, and Tony, both said, I mean, they didn't decide to do that, but you might still argue that they might even still have a sense of agency in that they're experiencing their hand going up and they're monitoring what they're doing and how that matches an intention of raising the arm, regardless of where that intention came from. So I'm not sure it's the best way to talk about it, to say that they don't have agency. Rather, they might not have a sense of agency. And then, I mean, of course, that might then modulate what kind of actions they're going to engage in or not. And so that raised the interesting question, or somebody raised the interesting question, like, what does that mean in sort of the broader sense of what their life is like and what they're doing in their life? Are they acting? I mean, I don't know, I guess, what it is that they're doing.
I think that's very good. Anybody else got another comment?
I think it would be interesting to say it's mealtime and you give them different options. And maybe there are two things they like and one thing they don't like, and see what happens. And you could ask afterwards, did you choose? And of course they're going to say, no, there was no choice, I didn't choose. But you'd get evidence of choice behavior from what they did. Instead of commanding him to raise his arm, put him in a situation where it matters to him what happens.
Do you want to say something? Remember, these people, you heard his description of love, these people are in permanent well-being and with an enormous sense of love and no suffering. So it's very different from our sense. It's a good question. What I'll do is I'll try, if I can get hold of some family, and then I can answer your question.
Yeah, I've shared this before, I'll say it again. I sort of see consciousness as being 99.999% of the time being concerned with the survival of this physical being and who this physical being considers itself to be, my ego. So my daily thoughts, you know, 24/7, and about sort of what we had for lunch, when we're going home, what I'm doing tonight, what day is it, it's all about my consciousness anchored to this. We've all had, and of course that's how it should be, because that's why we're here. I mean, it's an evolutionary selectable that we're primarily concerned with the survival of the physical being. Otherwise, we wouldn't have had progeny, we wouldn't be here. So that's one of the most selectable. Now, on the other hand, we've all had experience of our consciousness being liberated from this, being anchored to this bodily being. In a peak experience, sometimes you could meditate for months and you go out, boundaries disappear, you disappear, you are not a person, you have no name, and out there, it's just all perfect as it's meant to be. And also, I really know this because I'm prescribed ketamine for pain. And ketamine shuts down all your NMDA receptors. NMDA receptors are distributed throughout your neurology, throughout your body, and what they do is report to the brain what's happening in your body. Yeah. So if you shut down all the NMDA receptors, and this is why the kids take it and raves and so on. You're out of your body. You have no body. You can't feel your body. And the minute that happens on the ketamine, this is why the kids like it, because they have out-of-the-body experience, because they can't feel their body, then your consciousness gets liberated from the body, okay, as it does when you die. I sort of know that as well, not that I've died, but... so the experience of ketamine is everything is just perfect. Everything is just the way it's meant to be. So you don't have to do anything. You don't have to change anything. You don't have any list. You don't have to fix anything. You don't have to remember anything. You don't have to worry about anything. It's a sort of lovely, peaceful, blissful experience when your consciousness is liberated from being concerned with this, that it's all just as it's meant to be. And I think that's what these guys look like. So if everything is perfect, you don't have to fix, change, remember, make lists, then there's nothing, agency seems to be coming from anchored consciousness needing to manipulate your environment to suit yourself. Yeah. And if you're not there, you don't have agency because you don't have to change or fix anything because you're not there, because you can't feel yourself. Now, the effect of ketamine, as well as being used for pain, which is a fairly short-term effect, it's sort of a respite, but it has a long-term effect on depression, hasn't it?
Yes, it does.
Like for a week or so.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it's not damaging if it's not taken every day. It's taken maybe once a week or once every 2 weeks. And I think that the long-term effect in alleviating depression is that you've had this wonderful experience that everything's perfectly okay, just as it is. And it's just the memory of that experience that you sort of carry on in the next days, that it's, everything's okay. So you don't feel so depressed. Anyway, that's my experience.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks very much. That's exactly what it's meant to be like. Okay, I think, very quick.
Can I make a comment / question regarding the ketamine? I mean, it's interesting to associate that loss of agency with good feelings when, for example, I mean, depression tends to be associated with a loss of agency, with a loss of believing that one can change one's environment, which leads then there to frustration. And then also, I think, although I don't know exactly, but my sense is that the research so far on ketamine shows it's effective, but in the short term, not in very long term. So I just wonder about that.
Okay. Let's have questions from the floor. Any questions you want, and could you please say who they're for, which one of the speakers?
This is for everybody, I think, but it's responding also to Antonella and Ulissi. It's about the heart-mind, which I think the Buddhists recommend or prioritise. But also, I'm aware that the stomach is supposedly has more neurons than the brain. And for agency, I often trust my gut feeling and probably could practice learning to listen to my heart more. But how do we put that in context of what we've been discussing, agency and perhaps wisdom?
You know, there are many accounts about gut feelings and on premonition. And so in a way, all this area is linked to the vital functions and provides you information about the future. About agency and what we've seen in the film before, we know Spear, we've been to the meetings in Sand meetings and we've talked there, and we have some doubts about what we've seen. So we're not really sure that enlightenment goes through that way. Yes, you go. Okay. Yes, you can go.
I think that what we are seeing is just can be considered a stage, a step. I imagine that there is much more beyond this. When our heart opens up, we see love everywhere. We see beauty. And at that point, I'm thinking about, for example, Buddha or Jesus Christ, all these figures that had an open heart. And when your heart is open, in that moment, there is the maximum agency, in my opinion, yes. Because it's the real high. I don't agree with Rupert Spira when he says there is no I. I think there is one I, but it's different. Another I inside, which is not the ego, but it's a personality. So we can take part to life with all of us, the whole of us, with the physical part and the energetic part, so we know who we are. That's the starting point. So, and that's agency, maximum level of agency. In this way, people can act in the world, also giving their life to important missions. For example, all those people that go to Africa Medicine Without Frontiers, also this. It is possible to give our lives to a mission like this, saving others. So we are ready to do something good in the world with the time we have. So it's very much linked to altruism and acting from the heart.
I would add one thing, because when you say it from a mathematical point of view, the theory of syntropy, when you concentrate, you increase differentiation. So there is something very strange that happens. Unity increases diversity, whereas entropy leads to homogeneity. Mm-hmm. So if we want to go to unity and to love, we have to increase agency. It's not reducing agency. Our diversity increases, and it is very, very important to value the diversity of people and to really, in a way, be able to get to love through diversity. So a word that I often use is unity in diversity.
Just a small comment on that, this point of agency. And if you look at some of the stories around Peter Dunoff, who I was talking about earlier on, you'll find that he seemed to be aware of the situation that many of his followers were in. And if they got into a dangerous situation, he was actually able to intervene in that because they somehow they existed within his consciousness. And so I'm reinforcing what you said there. And in some cases, it was life-saving. And so I think it's very interesting to think of the sort of development of this, you know, towards a universal. But then you've got a universal sense of agency, which has an effect on individuals.
Professor Richard Selberstein, I wonder what you think about premonitory dreams. Sorry? Premonitory dreams, and a quick question as well for Antonella: déjà vu experiences.
There's premonitory dreams, or also just feelings about the future. There have been quite a few books written, and one of the things that I found interesting was studies that looked at the statistics of the usage of, say, public transport or certain areas. Prior to the time of major accidents, for example. So, for example, in the case of 9/11, in fact, there was, I understand, in some of the subways and some of the areas, there were sort of statistically a significant lower number of people that actually arrived. And I think there have been studies indicating that these are hard to do, suggesting that there's a similar analogous situation. In other words, it would be interpreted as people have a feeling about something in the future. Now, this is, we're not talking about seconds here, but we're talking about a much, much, much longer timescale. And I must admit, that does really throw up a big problem for free will. And people have looked at this on a number of occasions. I wonder if I could just indulge take the indulgence of the audience and just briefly comment on the issue of the reality of quote self and or its non-reality and as we saw there in terms of people who indicated they were liberated. I think that in some traditions, for example, in those particularly that might say have an acceptance of the notion of reincarnation, many of them have this notion that there is the self that we see here, the persona, is a transitory phenomenon, and that in the sense that it only lasts for a short period of time, it is constantly changing. It is determined by your genetics, your immediate influence, for all sorts of things. The sort of Richard Silverstein here, you know, right here and now is unique. Hopefully, when I'm a bit better, I'll be a different person. So in that sense, the sort of there is no sort of permanent real Richard. There is a flux, but the notion is that there is something deeper as well, which continues on a longer term basis. And that's the basis for some of the reincarnating entity, etc. And I think there is sometimes a confusion between the two. So that was all I wanted to say. Except I can't help myself, and I will leave with this final comment. I understand that those two gentlemen belong to a society. Sans something. Sans and non-duality. What I'm just wondering is how many people are there when they meet for their meetings.
No, in fact, those two don't belong to a society, but the comment is good. Okay, next one. Sorry.
I have to answer to deja vu. But usually deja vu are considered signals of a previous life. So I remember certain places, I find myself in, for example, a street, and I realize I know this street, although I've never been in that city, all these kind of things. I think that we are far... we need more time to study this kind of experiences, because when we get in contact with this absolute knowledge, which is in the center of our heart, we know everything. So we can happen to be in a place and know everything, but it doesn't mean necessarily that it has to do with my one previous life that I've lived before. Maybe I'm just channeling signals from other life experiences, because everything is connected. So in my opinion, there is much more to be studied and observed in this kind of experiences, to say a last word and in order to understand them. So in this sense, also the idea of reincarnation maybe can be quite different from what we think. So, thank you for your question.
Yeah. Yes.
Is this working? Can you hear me? Yeah. I'd like to come back to this subject of agency and how it relates to creativity, to anybody on the panel. I think Noura said quite a lot about it. One example that she gave, a kind of marker, was where you... correct your behaviour so that you can do better next time, that kind of thing. Now, what seems to happen when that kind of thought process takes place, indeed any thought process, is that you invoke compatible thoughts, and they seem to come from the ether or the universal mind or somewhere. They zoom in and it seems to be available to us, and it's the same with creativity, and we all know it. But it does enhance the sense of agency, but in fact, in a way, there is a sense in which it's a kind of gift, and the reason I'm putting forward is there's an old principle about energy follows thought, and this is, the thought invokes something, and it seems to come through this. Now, this is where it gets a bit tricky, because, of course, there's this mind substance, which we would say, perhaps some of us would say, is behind the brain activity. Has there been any academic research on this movement of energy, which comes as this gift to the person and gives them a sense of agency or a great sense of creating something? It's what's happening some way behind or before, should I say, the actual moment of creativity.
There has been some research on the moment of creativity, the so-called aha experience. I think a researcher in the state, Jung, has done quite a bit of work in this area. Now, there are certain patterns of brain activity. Now, the interpretation of this is all based on the nature of the experiment itself, which is what is happening in the brain, how is the brain organized, and this all is predicated on the notion that all emerges from the brain. So that's where we start. The point is that it appears, first of all, that the more creative brain have the capacity for creating these functional links between disparate regions and linking disparate regions more easily, and that there are certain patterns of activity which emerge, and much of the creative process appears to be unconscious. And in fact, only sort of appears to emerge. And there's quite a bit of research here on, you know, the preparation and then the sort of the germination phase and the incubation phase and then the aha phase. I know that in some cases when I've been working on a problem for quite some time and not getting terribly far, I can sense there's an idea about that will emerge soon. In the next few days, I can sort of feel it, and more often than not, something does come up and it tends to be useful. But these are all predicated on the ideas that it's these patterns of activity within the brain that give rise to this.
Okay.
Who's got the mic?
I've got one.
Yeah.
It's not so much a question, it's a sort of a clarification based on my own personal experiences, and it relates to your point about precognitive dreams in a way. In a meditation, I was told, after attempting to send healing to an individual, the next thing I heard was, it'll all be over by the end of April, 20th to the 23rd. And this was in December. And I knew at that instant that this person was not going to survive. And in fact happened, she went into a coma on the 20th. She died on the 23rd. There was a memorial service for her on the 29th, and then she was buried on the 30th. So from that and other similar type experiences and other examples of what I've been investigating, we're all energy. And each one of us has an impulse which creates our physical body. And when you come to the point in time, as the two gentlemen were explaining, at that point they can either remain in the body or they can release the body and move into wherever they're going to move to, into this open place of love or whatever else may be described that way. So all of your information that I've been receiving over this weekend from the scientific aspect is fine. It's putting an explanation onto the things that I've been receiving in other realms and giving me a definition of it, but really that is an approach from the physical trying to explain the non-physical as opposed to perceiving it from the other perspective. And I think once we start looking at things from that perspective, we'll get a clearer impression as to what we are and what we're really doing here. But each one of us has chosen to be here for a specific purpose, and each one of us is doing that, I think, to the best we can.
Can I move over to the animals for a bit, away from humans? If we look at experiences of tsunamis, of volcanoes, of earthquakes, of Rupert Sheldrake's investigation into dogs, what we see is that animals will react to a forthcoming disaster, or in the case of the dogs, the coming home of their master, before there's any physical evidence of these things occurring. From what we've heard today, do we now have an explanation for this type of reaction?
Can I? Yeah. Yes. Well, you know, working on this idea about syntropy of the autonomic nervous system, you really get the idea that when you're connected, and simple animals, like, for example, insects, they are directly connected to their autonomic nervous system, then they would be able to sense, to feel the future. And I had direct experiences with earthquakes, for example, L'Aquila in Abruzzi, and you could see insects reacting like if they were drunk before each shock, tremor. Well, in one of the conferences, the head of the Geological Institute in Italy really got very interested, because the idea was, well, we can get insects, monitor them, and then try to correlate their behavior to what is going to come. But, you know, with mainstream science, that is forbidden, totally forbidden. The idea that you can have retrocausal information in a way conflicts so much with the mechanistic paradigm that you're not allowed to work in that direction. I know that these kind of applications are only developed in China, where they're monitoring animals in such a way that they can predict earthquakes. But I don't know of any of that in Italy or generally in the West.
Okay, I think we'll have to end there, I'm afraid, because we're coming up to time. I have here a note from Beata Bishop, which I'll read out to you, because in many ways I think what she says here does summarize our conference. You remember, are we free spirits or automatism? And she says, if we substitute "and also" for "or" in the subject of our meeting, the answer might be that we're free spirits within the limitations of our individual settings, level of consciousness, and ability to grow. A good analogy is psychological astrology, which holds that the birth chart describes the framework of the individual psyche within a life, within a lifetime, but the pattern outside it, planets and aspects, leaves plenty of scope for choice, which equals practicing our free will and making us free spirits within our boundaries. So I think as a nice summary, that will do very well. It's time now for me to thank David and the program committee for putting this conference together, although David will be summing up the conference. From my point of view, I think that what we've learned is that thoughts can affect our genetics absolutely directly. So it actually does matter what we think. So what about that cancel technique for all you guys? So I'd like you all to thank David and the program committee very much for everything that they've done for this conference.
And thank you, Peter. I'd like to add my thanks to the program committee and to all our speakers, some of whom come a very long way indeed. In fact, if we add up the air miles, it might be quite embarrassing from a sort of ecological point of view. But I'm all the more grateful for that. And I think that we've had this variety of perspectives on our subject, and I think that's been the richness of the weekend, is having had philosophy, psychology, neuroscience, mindfulness, biology, genetics, Alexander technique. I mean, where else would you find such a wide range of contributions? I shouldn't forget syntropy.
And I think, you know, from that point of view, I find the conference has fully lived up to my hopes and expectations. And I think we've had an extraordinarily rich mix of inputs to take away and reflect on. So I'd like you to join me in thanking the speakers in particular for their contributions and what they put into the conference. Then I'd like to thank Peter for his support and chairing. And then it's also the two MRs, Martin Redfern and Michelle Robinson, who have made such a wonderful contribution to the smooth running of the, and recording indeed, of the conference. So can I ask you to put your hands together? And just a couple of dates for your diary. We have a conference, and because we've been changing our booking systems, this is the reason why you haven't heard so much about this. But the 31st of October, we've got a day conference celebration on Albert Schweitzer, looking at his contributions to theology, philosophy, medicine, and music, and we're very lucky to have Simon Dearsley coming not only to talk about the music but to give an organ recital as well towards the end of the day. So I think that'll be quite a special day. And then Mystics and Scientists next year is 15th to 17th of April, that's the date for your diary, and we have Larry Dossey coming, which is very exciting. And we've got a few other speakers as well, including, for Di's interest, Vera Hellerman is coming, and she's an awakened Dutch mother of four. And so you'll be able to you'll be able to find out maybe some answers to your questions. And we've also got Tom McLeish, FRS, coming from Durham, and the topic is non-locality and the oneness of mind. And I don't think I can really add very much more to this summary from Beata. I thought that was really excellent as a sort of positioning of obviously we are influenced, determined in many respects, but I think it's important for us to remember that we do have possibilities, new possibilities, as our life unfolds. And I think we're moving, hopefully, from in the direction of away from the conditioned towards the unconditioned, away from unfreedom, lack of freedom, towards freedom. And at the same time, this freedom seems to be associated with a sense of love, expansion, and a sense of light and wisdom. So if we can be moving in that direction, and this conference has helped us at all to do that, then I think it's been a very worthwhile weekend, and I thank you also for coming. I'd just like to blow the candle out. Those speakers who are within range can help me. And you can all have a blow as well, because it's all a universal process. So
you're going to say ready, set, go?
3, 2, 1.
Hi.
Thank you very much.